Our next case this morning is United States against Tedder. Mr. Goldberg.
Given my travel, I appreciate the court's indulging me with two early arguments, although I wasn't sure back-to-back was going to happen. For the record, may it please the court, my name is Peter Goldberger, and it is also my privilege this morning to represent David Tedder, who was the appellant here and was the defendant below. We have articulated two categories of error arising out of the trial, one having to do with the limitation on the defendant's ability to corroborate his defense of lack of knowledge key to the money laundering charges, and the second, the government's attack on the defendant's credibility as a witness, going beyond the bounds of permissible attack when the defendant hasn't offered character testimony. The judge set in limine very strict limitations on what Mr. Tedder could offer in his defense with respect to the critical knowledge element on money laundering. And what we're talking about here is knowledge of, it's an unusual mens rea because it involves knowledge of illegality. It's clear on the face of the statute that to be guilty of a 1957 money laundering charge or conspiracy to violate 1957, you have to know that the proceeds, which are the corpus of the transactions, constitutes the proceeds of an illegal activity. And I think it's not disputed that knowledge of the illegality of that activity is essential. The defendant's position was, and he so testified, that he didn't know that it was illegal. Government was allowed to offer quite a lot of evidence to substantiate their position that he ought to have known and probably did know.
And how much evidence was the government allowed to put in on this point?
I'll give you some examples. They were allowed to show that there was in a file in the defendant's office a copy of, I think, the indictment and a press release about the indictment of someone indicted, the first person who had been indicted in the country was in New York City on similar charges. Newspaper clippings in which government officials were quoted as saying that internet gambling is illegal, violates the Wage Wire Act. What it really amounted to, opinions of government officials was offered, and we don't dispute that that's admissible if it was shown to have come to the defendant's attention as evidence that would be relevant to the question of what he knew. But he didn't have to believe those opinions, not even the opinion of a grand jury in New York, that the conduct was illegal, and he was entitled to show that notwithstanding what he may have read, he didn't believe it, and therefore, because he didn't believe it, didn't know it. Yet he wasn't allowed to show that the milieu in which he was operating was full of people who shared this belief that what they were doing was perhaps on the edge, but was not over the edge and was not illegal.
But wasn't the district judge's basic problem that these people he was surrounded by were non-lawyers?
Yes, it was.
Who could not give a legal opinion.
But I don't think that people's opinions of what is and isn't legal to do in any way can be properly limited to what they're told to their face by lawyers. I mean, that's not how we learn what's illegal. We have learned.
You think that's how lawyers learn what's illegal? I mean, your position seems to be that lawyers learn what's illegal by ignoring what's in the U.S. Code, by ignoring what prosecutors think, by ignoring what grand juries think, and by listening to laymen.
Well, he certainly didn't ignore what was in the U.S. That's not at all my position. That's completely incorrect.
He's consented, I assume, to disbarment, because any lawyer who learns about law that way is worse than incompetent.
Well, I'm not arguing my client's disciplinary hearing here, but I don't agree with the premises of your three fingers of how he learned the law. None of that is correct and fair. He did not ignore what was in the U.S. Code. He had read this provision of the U.S. Code and concluded, as many others had, that it did not prohibit this conduct.
And you don't see any distinction between him getting an opinion from non-lawyers versus a lawyer when he indeed is a lawyer?
I see a distinction. I think it's a lot more reliable to get independent advice from a lawyer. But it's not the only evidence which can fairly be treated as relevant or not more prejudicial than probative.
Suppose this were a tax protester case where we have the standard claim that although the Internal Revenue Service has told me there is an obligation to pay taxes, and every court in the country has said that, I just don't believe it. On your view, is the defendant legally entitled to present the live testimony of every leader of the American tax protest movement?
Not every leader, no.
But what would be a limit on the number of such leaders?
Enough.
The actual number that's usually used is zero, by the way.
Yes, I know.
But on your view, what would be the limit?
I don't know that that's been sustained in this circuit, and certainly not by the Supreme Court, as a proper application of Cheek. And I have seen such cases, and I am troubled by them, and I think that I criticized your previous question, but this is a valid analogy.
Answer my question.
I do.
In your view, what would be the limit?
The judge can put a limit beyond which it is more waste of time than useful to the jury, more prejudicial than probative,
all right.
But
the
not
judge
a limit
picked, the judge
in discretion.
Two
yes.
In this case.
One.
What
really
was wrong with that?
Really, the limit was one if the defendant chose to testify.
Yep.
And two. What was wrong with the limit of two?
Because it created a false impression to this jury that there was no basis for the defendant's asserted belief, that it was contrary to the unlimited opportunity of the government to present whatever they wished, and instead...
No, but the court said two witnesses could testify. If he chose not to testify, they could testify about their knowledge of illegality, what their views were, provided that that had been told to the defendant. That's the part
yes.
that wasn't met, right?
That's right. That's
so,
right.
I mean, what's the point? If they didn't tell the defendant, then what's the relevance?
Because
that's what I'm not getting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and what I've tried to get across, I apologize if I didn't in my brief, in this respect, is that we learn what other people think, not just for what they tell us to their face, but by how they behave. We observe how people behave, and we hear them speak to others. And the fact that it wasn't said directly to the defendant's face is meaningless.
On that view, you would be able to call, in your last case, you'd be able to call every crack dealer in Chicago and put them all on the stand and say, did you deal crack? And that would, of course, lead in your client's mind to the implication that that must be lawful.
No.
If it
wouldn't be relevant. That wouldn't even be relevant. I mean, that's not relevant. But are you assuming hypothetically that it were relevant?
Is
knowledge of the law is not a ignorance of the law is not a defense to that charge.
It's usually said that drug dealing is a specific intent crime.
It is a specific intent crime. It's a specific intent to distribute, not the knowledge of the law. It's not a willfulness crime in the Ratzlaff sense. But I understand. I take your analogy, putting that point aside. And again, it's the suggestion that there's no space between one and unlimited is not warranted. What you had here is that, in fact, in this case, there was such a restriction placed that the defendant could not present his defense. If the judge set some other limit and the defense objected to that limit and brought it up on appeal, then we'd address that limit.
Did you object, by the way, to the limit of two?
Oh, yes. This was debated at an in-limit. Well, it wasn't me, but my predecessor, yes.
The transcript does contain the statement when the judge said two, the counsel said, that's all I want, Your Honor.
I have to look at that whole... I don't know if you want to take the time now.
That was consent.
I don't know which passage that is, so I can't comment on it directly. I know that that's not the full context of what happened at the in limine hearing or at the trial when the limits were placed. There was objection after objection, and of course, an in limine ruling is without prejudice. Was objected to at trial repeatedly when these limits were placed. Nor do I think the government has raised that objection. If that is a valid objection, it was waived by the government in its brief. There was no consent argument made in the government's brief in that respect. If I could turn to the character evidence question, the defendant testified he didn't call character witnesses. That put his veracity in issue, but no other trait of character. The government continues to assert there is no difference between honesty in general and veracity in the specific. The case law all belies that. The rule belies that. The comments, the committee comments to the rule belies it. And it's completely, in this case, was so prejudicial because the defendant is, in effect, tarred with being dishonest.
It's a subset of honesty, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. All veracity is part of honesty. Not all honesty is veracity. That's the problem. It's exactly the problem.
Isn't that a pretty fine point in this?
I think it's a very fine point.
Context.
I think it's a winning point.
Well, such a fine point that when we're using an abuse of discretion standard, it would suggest to me that we should affirm the district court if the distinction is that fine. It's an abuse of discretion standard.
I think it's a subtle. It may be a subtle point, but it ought to be perfectly clear when articulated that these are two different things, and they go to a point of very fundamental fairness to a defendant who is charged with being being crooked. Easterbrook suggested being a disbarrable, bad lawyer. His brothers were allowed to testify that he wasn't an honest person, didn't testify and over a multiple years, rather than the relevant and narrow question, which is whether these days, today, not today, but
was
in contemporaneously, he's
a formulation of the question.
Yes, there was. First, it was an objection on the formulation of the question.
Yes,
it was an objection to these witnesses testifying at all.
No, that's my question. Well, was there an objection to the precise formulation of the question?
No, there was not. Nor do I think that objection has been made again by the government in their brief.
The objection made that their knowledge was stale.
Yes, that objection was made. That was the first one of the three principal objections, as I discussed at some length in the reply brief.
The problem is the correct question is the person's reputation. And even if you haven't seen him in the past few years, you may well know his reputation for honesty.
It has to be his current reputation.
Yes.
Or your current opinion.
That's why it matters what the formulation of the question is.
I know it does. I agree with you.
Well, doesn't your objection really go to the weight of the testimony, not the admissibility? And certainly they were cross-examined on
mm-hmm.
timing, correct?
Yes, they were.
So it was before the jury. The context of their opinions and the time frame.
Well,
and there was cross-examination that this wasn't
evidence
current.
It wasn't as bad as if there hadn't been. But inadmissible evidence that's cross-examined is still inadmissible. I don't think the harm was taken away by the allowance of cross-examination. It was compounded by the giving of the wrong character instruction, by the way, where the instruction that was given was the instruction that applies to situations where the defendant has called character witnesses and would then be subject to this broader impeachment, as compared with the credibility of witness instruction that the defense wanted, which is the one where the only trait in issue is veracity. That's the instruction that the defense requested. Again, showing the defense perceived this distinction when they formulated their request for jury instructions, and yet the judge gave, at the government's request, the broader instruction, focusing on the wrong distinction.
I think the issue is how material is this distinction in the instructions, for example.
Well, I would say that it's so prejudicial to the defendant to have his general character for honesty impugned in a money laundering case. That, as opposed to his veracity in testifying, that it couldn't be harmless when a defendant testifies.
Now, go ahead. I'm sorry. This Passione case you're familiar with, our Seventh Circuit case, where
we held that
reputation testimony that was more than 10 years old was proper for the court to admit, and that's
yes.
what we've got here, 10 years. So how do you draw a distinction between that case?
I don't see any indication anywhere in the Passione decision that the staleness issue was raised in that case. It was focused on a different the legal issue raised by the appellant in that case appears to have been a different one. It shouldn't have been come out that way, but it was. It doesn't appear to have been the issue decided in the case. It was also a plain error case, if I remember right, where we claim a proper objection. If I could
if
turn...
If the jury, jury thinks that this fellow is lying on the witness stand, they're unlikely to conclude that he's an honest man, are they?
What they need to be told is not is that it doesn't
matter.
You can make
distinctions between those breeds of honesty?
What you say is certainly true, but what they needed to be told was that it's not a basis for verdict whether they believe he's an honest man or not, that we don't convict people in this country in our criminal justice system based on character but only on conduct and state of mind and not on character. That would have been precisely the wrong thing to do. That was not the question before the jury, and it was just the danger that this improper instruction and improper evidence might have led them to. I'm not sure quite what my remaining time is, but I think I ought to turn to the sentencing questions.
Mm-hmm.
We have one guideline calculation issue here of that's in play for appeal, and that is that the court added 2 years to this sentence, three levels, based on an enhancement because the conduct under this particular application note to Section 2S1.1 violated 1956, when the proper construction of that guideline and its application note is that although the conspiracy provision is found in Section 1956H, when the objective of the conspiracy is, as here, solely to violate 1957, that the correct application of the guidelines, and as is the correct application of sentencing law in general, is to sentence as a 1957 case, that is, a $10,000 transactions case rather than a specific intent.
Your
to
position
the
here
case.
Has got to be that the guidelines and the notes to them are incorrect.
Yes.
If they're literally correct, you don't have any argument, right?
That's right. It's a Scrivener's error case. That's absolutely right. And I was surprised that I hadn't found them. I think they're rare in the guidelines because they're scrupulously edited. But this, for five or six reasons articulated in the brief, does appear to be an error. There is no rational explanation for placing a conspiracy to violate 1957 into that particular subsection. It completely is contrary to everything else on the subject in the guidelines and in the U.S. Code. It appears to be an editorial error in the compiling of that
Does
rule.
Does anything in your argument depend on whether it's a mistake or correct? I thought your argument really depends on 1956H.
Mm-hmm. The language of the statute, you mean?
Yes, on the language of the statute. And if That's some application note contradicts the language of the statute, then
yes.
The statute wins. That's just the hierarchy.
That's one of our arguments. That is one of our arguments.
Yeah.
It's because it's not a statute that directs the commission to write a guideline in a certain way. I didn't put all my weight on that, but I certainly fully endorse what you're saying, and it is one of our principal arguments, absolutely. That's the only mechanical guideline issue. And then, of course, we have a Booker constitutional issue and so forth, which I will skip over and take your cue on that. But and mention to you that we also have a miscalculation in the fine in the amount of $500,000 double counted, same $500,000 counted with respect to one count and then another and added in. Government's got no answer to the arithmetic basis of that argument. And then fundamental and serious errors in the way the forfeiture was conducted here. The judge just realized after trying the forfeiture count to the jury under Rule 32.2B that there were three basic serious mistakes in the instruction she had given the jury. The points that had been briefed extensively by the defense before, but which the judge didn't appear to study until after. And so she set aside this $10 million verdict, forfeiture verdict by the jury, and proceeded to try to recalculate it herself. That was a denial of the statutory right to jury trial. We say constitutional, but that's for another day in another court.
Your problem there... There is that there is another court. The Supreme Court in Libretti said that there's no right to jury trial on these forfeiture issues.
I'd love to discuss
so
that.
So if what's going on is that the district judge has effectively granted summary judgment on a forfeiture question. What's wrong with that?
Violates Rule 32.2b4, and that entitles Congress intended the defense to have.
Well, the rule says the jury must determine whether the government has established the requisite nexus between mm-hmm. the property and the
That's
offense
right.
committed by the defendant. Now,
That's right.
Didn't the jury make that determination in this case?
No, they didn't. They made it on improper instructions.
Right, the argument is about how much is involved in that.
Right, but when in a money laundering case, the question is what is the nexus, whether the jury has found a nexus with respect to each amount of money, not whether there was any money involved, because each transaction stands on its own footing and each
well,
sum of money stands on
it. That's not a nexus issue, is it?
Oh, I think that is the nexus. It's the use of the proceeds of crime in a prohibited money laundering transaction is the nexus.
Well, didn't the jury find that? They just found it excessively because of the duplication of the money that was involved.
We don't know which transactions they found because of the general verdict. Any of these, each transaction was for the jury to look at. The court, the other point, I'm out of my opening time.
Let's just come back to the summary judgment question.
Sure.
I don't understand what the problem is. In civil cases, even though there is a constitutional right to a jury trial, if there's no material dispute, the judge can grant summary judgment.
Yes.
It's always been thought that the Sixth Amendment is different.
Yes.
But Libretti says that there's no Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial
yes.
about forfeiture. So why can't the judge, if the judge finds there's no material dispute and that your client owes at least $2.5 million, grant summary judgment?
There is no summary judgment in criminal cases at all.
That's just asserting the conclusion. Why can't the judge, given that the Sixth Amendment does not create yes. a right to jury trial about forfeiture, grant summary judgment?
It seems to me that Congress would have to create, or the Rules Committee without
no,
Congress.
Actually, summary judgment long predated anything Congress did, and it's based not even today in anything Congress did. It's based in Rule 56.
Yes. Well, that's what I was going to say, and it's something that the Judicial Conference Rules Committee did without Congress stopping them is what I was going to finish. That was where I was going.
Of course, it predated Civil Rule 56.
Well, I didn't know that, and I take your word for it because mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Goldberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Craver.
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dan Graber. I'm an assistant United States attorney. I was also the lead prosecutor in the trial of this case. The first issue the counsel brings up is the issue of Judge Crabb excluding hearsay evidence that the defendant wished to bring in and the non-lawyers, the 50 or so non-lawyers that he wanted to bring in to testify about their knowledge as to whether offshore sports betting was illegal or not. Judge Crabb did not abuse her discretion in excluding that. She made the proper rulings under hearsay 801 and under 403. A waste of the jury's time to hear from a bunch of non-lawyers. We argued in the pretrial hearing that he could bring some of these witnesses in to talk about hearsay as long as those witnesses communicated those views to the defendant. Then there's a non-hearsay use effect on the listener. Judge Crabb agreed with that, and Judge Crabb also said, though, put a limit on two witnesses or if the defendant's going to testify, one witness. He did bring in another witness, a lawyer, Bruce Meager, who did testify and say that he communicated his views of legality to Tedder. Tedder then took the stand and testified that he had spoken to three lawyers, all of whom had told him that it was totally legal. This in contravention to a pretrial position when I had filed a motion in limine saying
I'm surprised you didn't move to hold him in contempt.
I didn't because I wanted to be able to make this argument today of having him say those things, allowing him to bring that out.
Were there any 403 objections to the evidence that you put in on the other side of this question?
No. There were no 403 objections. The only objection they made was this limiting under hearsay that they were trying to argue that it's he should be allowed to call these witnesses even though they never communicated their views to the defendant, and they couldn't get around the hearsay issue. The second issue that he brings up, Your Honor, is the government calling in rebuttal the defendant's two brothers as character witnesses, and counsel argues again that we were trying to do some kind of 404A attack, honesty versus veracity. And as the court has pointed out, we asked the question, do you think he's honest or not? Both brothers said, no, he's not honest. That's allowed under 608A. That is what they argued down below at the trial. They argued a 608A objection, and they were trying to say, since the brothers hadn't seen him in 10 years, there's a 10-year foundation requirement. That's wrong. There isn't a 10-year foundation requirement. Piccioni says that, and this 404A argument that they're making now of honesty, that we were bringing in an honesty defense, that was never raised down below, and they failed to recognize that. In my brief, I point out to the court this kind of objection is forfeited and therefore reviewed under plain error, and they can't meet the plain error standard.
But with respect to that Piccioni case, did the court actually rule on that 10-year period? That wasn't the central issue in the case.
No, it wasn't, Your Honor. But yeah. that's the only opinion I could find in the Seventh Circuit on
this
issue.
Right, but there was no discussion of that. It wasn't raised as error. And isn't there something to be said about the fact that their views were 10 years old and that was nowhere near the relevant fraud claim, or
correct,
not the money laundering claims,
correct,
here?
And since you have to review this particular claim under under the plain error, he's never going to be able to show prejudice because he had a full and fair opportunity on cross-examination with both brothers and spent a lot of time talking about the fact you haven't talked to David in 10 years, have you? In fact, you're in litigation with your brother over your inheritance that's been going on for 15 years. So he had an opportunity to bring that on in cross-examination. The third issue I want to bring up is the jury instruction issue that counsel brings up with regards to 3.12 out of the pattern. 3.12 is the character for witness. You guys have 3.06, which says character for defendant, and 3.12, which is character for witness. Judge Crabb, in the charging conference on day four of the trial, runs through all the instructions. When she got to 3.12, and this is on page 34 of my brief, there's a colloquy there that I pull out. She asked counsel, do you want 312 in or out? And they say they want 312 out, both defense attorneys. That's waiver, Your Honor, and that ends the appellate review of that issue right there. And I put that in my brief on page 34. Counsel also brings up the fact that she erred because she used 306 when she was trying to instruct the jury on what to do when you're dealing with the character evidence of the defendant. That's what 306 is for. It's not 312. 312 is character evidence of a witness. 306 is character evidence on the defendant. She didn't err. She did it correctly. And by the way, again, that point was never raised down below. That's a point they're bringing up on appeal. Again, a forfeited error that has to be reviewed under plain error. The next issue that counsel brings up is the issue on the sentencing, the Scrivener's error argument, because...
Forget the Scrivener's error.
Okay.
Why isn't this resolved by the language of 1956H, which says that any person who conspires to commit the money laundering offense shall be subject to the same penalties as those prescribed for the offense, the commission of which was the object of the conspiracy? That has to trump any guidelines. If the guidelines say, no, sentence them in some different way, the statute has to win. And so why isn't, under the statute, the sentence have to be the one prescribed for those, the offense, the commission of which was the object of the conspiracy?
The guidelines address that issue, Your Honor. And that's why.
Guidelines can't supersede statutes.
No, but what I'm saying is the guidelines...
Especially not now.
You're right. But the guidelines address the issue in the application note when they make a distinction between an A1 defendant and an A2 defendant. And the guidelines say... For an A2 defendant, you can exclude out.
I don't understand that. Can you reconcile that with the language of this statute? Or to put it differently, what part of the word any in the phrase any person is ambiguous?
The guidelines saw...
Talk about the statute.
Correct.
Stop talking about the guidelines.
But the guidelines...
Tell me in what way 1956H is ambiguous.
It's not ambiguous, and the guidelines take 56H into account because they specifically say, if you look at application note, which it's application note 3C, the guidelines specifically address the issue that you're talking about and say, if it's a 56H case and it, and the object is 57, then you don't use the 2-point enhancement for 56, you use the 1-point enhancement for 57. Your Honor, the guidelines specifically address the issue that you're asking me about, and the guidelines make a distinction, Your Honor, between A1 defendants and A2 defendants, and it makes sense, because an A1 defendant, Your Honor, is a defendant who engaged in the underlying SUA. An A2 defendant doesn't. And if you look at the next section of the guidelines...
Could you, by any chance, discuss the statute?
Well,
Your Honor, you just have nothing to say about it?
Your Honor, I agree with everything you're saying about the statute, and I'm saying if you take the next step, the statute's recognized in the application note.
This introduces an element that the statute does not address, as far as I can make out.
Correct. And it introduces it by making a distinction between an A1 and an A2 defendant.
And I'm asking how such a distinction is possible under the statute. You haven't told me anything about the statute.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I guess I'm not making myself clear. But, and the best I can say is that the application note takes on the statute and specifically says...
It improves the statute? Is that what you're telling us?
You betcha. It improves the statute, Your Honor. It adds another wrinkle to the statute. Okay, the next issue, the fine... Counsel argues that the fine was wrong, that it was double counted. That's a real simple one, Your Honor, and that has to do with the guideline, the C2, under the 5E1.2, C2 says there's a cap on the guidelines, and in this case it was 10,000 to 100,000 because he was a level 24. But C4 trumps the C2 cap, and C4 says if you were convicted of a statute that
How
had...
How many trumps have you got in this deck?
A lot. We did a good job in this case. C4 trumps C2, Your Honor. And C4 says you can use the statutory maximum if the statute allows for a statutory maximum over and above the usual $250,000, which in this case we had two counts, counts 2 and count 6, that went above the statutory maximum. Judge Crabb correctly recognize those and correctly apply the C4 exception to come up with $1 million fine. It's very simple. There was no double counting. Defense seems to suggest that there needs to be some kind of grouping. You'll notice when you look at C4 in the application note, which is 5, it specifically doesn't address C4. You also, there's United States versus Young, where this circuit has already said when you have multiple counts like that and you add them together, you don't group them like that. The last issue I want to bring up is the forfeiture issue that they raise, and they say that the judge impermissibly changed the forfeiture verdict. She did not impermissibly change the forfeiture verdict. They filed a Rule 29 motion, and that was the vehicle she used to reduce the number. From I asked for $10 million, the jury came back with 7.2. The jury was asked the nexus question, which under Rule 32.2 we're supposed to do, and they decided nexus and said 7.2. They filed a Rule 29 motion. She took that under advisement. They filed a motion with 8 different reasons on why that verdict was wrong. She denied it on 7 of the 8. And on the last one, she granted it, saying that there was a double counting issue. I disagreed with her on double counting. She said, "Mr. Graber, back the double counting out. Show me how to do it." I said, "Yes, ma'am," and I did it. I backed them out. We had a hearing on it, and it reduced from $7.2 million to $2.7. She had the authority under Rule 29 to do that. Their brief complete.
Was that a nexus issue? Your opponent says it's a nexus issue, as I understand.
It's not a nexus issue. It's a double counting issue.
The
nexus was already decided.
Explain it to us.
The nexus was already decided. The jury found $7.2 million was dirty proceeds. All we were asking for were proceeds, money laundering proceeds. 7.2, they decided, was dirty. Some of that was double counted. And the judge said, take the double counting money out. It reduced it down to $2.7 million. She had the authority under Rule 29 to do exactly that, and that's what she did. They also make the argument, and you brought this up, Judge Easterbrook, with regards to Libretti. He doesn't have a jury right, Libretti says.
Well, he doesn't have a constitutional jury right.
Correct. He doesn't have that right to have a jury. And he keeps bringing that back, and that's not that's not the way it works. If you read 32.2 says it's part of the criminal sentencing process. The judge makes the decision. The judge determines the amount. The judge determines whether there should be a personal money judgment and how much. The judge determines substitute asset. That's all within the judge's purview as part of the sentencing, not the jury's. The jury's a simply nexus, and the jury was asked the nexus question in a special verdict, and that's the amount they came up with. I don't have anything else unless you've got any further questions.
How about this case on the other side of that issue? The Fifth Circuit, I think. I can't remember where what circuit, but that cited on the other side of this.
On the forfeiture
point, yeah.
He cited a 10th Circuit case, Bornfield, an 11th Circuit case, Gilbert.
Gilbert, that's the one I'm talking
okay.
about.
Okay. Gilbert is distinguished, Your Honor, because Gilbert was a facilitating asset case. In Gilbert, the court ordered the forfeiture of a business as a facilitating asset, and the defendant, Mr. Gilbert, and his co-defendant said, wait a minute, you're asking us to forfeit this business as a facilitating item, under RICO, by the way, and they said, we don't own it. We're not the owners. These other guys are the owners. And as you know, under forfeiture, you can only forfeit the defendant's interest in an asset, and if they have no interest in the asset, then you can't forfeit that. Therefore, the 11th Circuit came back and said, you can't forfeit that business if they don't own it. That's what Gilbert held, and that wasn't the issue in this case. We weren't trying to go after facilitating assets. When I wrote this thing, the indictment, I wrote it so that it would simply be the forfeiture count would deal with money laundering proceeds, would deal with very simple issue, how much dirty money was generated as a result of that offshore sports betting business. I could have gone after other assets and other facilitating assets and put that in the forfeiture indictment. I didn't. I simply said...
You're saying that Gilbert have raised the nexus question and that's why they had to go back to the jury? Is that
no. Gilbert's issue, Your Honor, had to do with the fact that...
Well, I know they didn't own the correct. Business had other owners. I understand
correct.
That.
And that was...
They said you had to go back to the jury, right? You couldn't just fix up the... jury verdict.
No, what was happening was the judge was trying to do, was trying to order forfeiture, and the judge didn't understand that the defendant's interest, that the defendant didn't have an interest in that. But that case did not say that it went back to the jury. None of the cases he cites say that it has to go back to the jury, because that's incorrect. And under Rule 32.2, that's clearly the position, that it doesn't go back to the jury. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our next case this morning is United States.